Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and founding pastor of Mercy Community Church of Little Rock. I'm joined this and every week by my friend and colleague, Dr. Amy Robertson, Executive Director of Congregation Beit Haverim, a Reconstructionist Jewish synagogue in Atlanta. This week, the narrative lectionary continues with the beginning of Jesus' public ministry as told in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 21 to 45. Jesus' first public teaching, his first public healing, and his first exorcism of an unclean spirit. We discuss what it means to teach with authority, how preaching sometimes takes precedence over healing, both in Jesus' ministry and in our own, and the comforting knowledge that even Jesus sometimes became exhausted by the demands of his ministry. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Bobby, how are ya?
Hey, Amy, I'm good. How are you?
I am doing well.
Yeah, so this week the narrative lectionary has us in Mark 1, 21 through 45.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to encounter unclean spirits and sick mothers-in-law and... leprosy? Like, this is action-packed stuff right here.
There is some action-packed stuff, yes.
So, I don't think there's anything we're going to need to do by way of context. Anything we need to do by way of context?
I don't think so. I mean, it really picks right up where we left off. The context is that we just picked up some fishermen so they could be fishers of men.
That's exactly what has happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, why don't we just jump on in Mark chapter 1, verse 21. Jesus and his followers went into Capernaum. Immediately, on the Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and started teaching. The people were amazed by his teaching, for he was teaching them with authority, not like the legal experts. Suddenly, there in the synagogue, a person with an evil spirit screamed, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are. You are the Holy One from God." "Silence," Jesus said, speaking harshly to the demon. "Come out of him." The unclean spirit shook him and screamed, then it came out. Everyone was shaken and questioned among themselves, "What's this? A new teaching with authority. He even commands unclean spirits, and they obey him." Right away, the news about him spread throughout the entire region of Galilee.
It's a pretty dramatic scene.
It is a dramatic scene, yeah, there's a lot.
This is like the first, am I right that in Mark this is the first sort of like moment of public ministry, religious leadership for Jesus, right?
Yeah, so we get that brief little notice in chapter 1, 14. Jesus came into Galilee announcing God's good news, saying, "Now is the time, here comes God's kingdom."
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's really meant to be understood.
At least it's more informal.
Yeah, this is the first, like, real story about the kind of thing Jesus was doing. That's exactly
mm-hmm.
right.
Before we even get to that, in this very first verse you read, verse 21, he entered the synagogue and taught.
Can you say a little bit about why that sticks out to you?
During the time of the temple, the primary sort of commanded worship for the Jewish community was through the temple cult. It was not going to synagogue every Friday night. Synagogues were starting to crop up at this time, but they were a little bit more like community centers.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Jews gathered in them for meetings and meals, and since it is the Sabbath here, they probably were gathering for some kind of Shabbat study or maybe worship, but it wasn't like there was a service being led by a rabbi the way you would find if you went into a synagogue now. I guess what stood out to me was that the temple's still standing, right? There still is that temple cult.
Absolutely.
And there's also this parallel practice sort of in formation.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think for Christians, sometimes those synagogue temple, like, yada yada, like, it's all they all seem kind of the same to us, but they're in this period really not at all
they're really different. Well, and it's confusing too, because the reform movement of Judaism now calls synagogues temples.
That's right.
So that is a totally reasonable point of confusion.
Yeah. Now, my understanding is that so one didn't have to be particularly a religious leader or a rabbi, like you were
mm-hmm.
saying, in order to teach in the synagogue. It was kind of open to people who are members of the community to read the scripture, to interpret, and to kind of, you know, argue and wrestle with the interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I think it does sound right. There wasn't sort of a clear authority structure for how all of this was going to work in synagogues.
Yeah.
So I think that's right. But I do think it's really interesting that it then goes on to say, he taught them as one having authority. What do you think that means?
There's nothing particularly dramatic about the fact of Jesus' teaching, but there is something about Jesus' teaching.
Yes, that
stands
apart.
The people in the next in the text noticed. They were amazed by his teaching, for he was teaching them with authority, not like the legal experts or not like the scribes.
My translation, the NRSV, has "not as the scribes."
Yeah, I think
that's
right.
And so I guess I was picturing it as sort of, it's not just handing down the teachings that you've heard from other folks.
Yeah.
But coming up with your own interpretations and feeling entitled to do that. Like having the spiritual or intellectual prowess and the confidence to offer a teaching of your own.
I think that's exactly right. I love the way you said that. The other thing that I think is worth noticing is, so the text says he taught with authority here, and then it says it again in 27. A new teaching with authority. He even commands unclean spirits. And situated in between those two descriptions of Jesus teaching with authority, there's an exorcism.
There sure is. There's just that little exorcism.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think those are related. And, you know, and Mark has this technique he uses that scholars call intercalation, or the non-scholarly term is sandwiching of stories. You know, there's a story with another story stuck in the middle of it, and you're supposed to interpret the two stories together. So the fact that there's a story about Jesus teaching with authority and in the middle of it is an exorcism, in my mind, means that the exorcism has something to do with their sense of his authority. So I think those two things together, Jesus teaches with an authority that doesn't depend on the teachings of his predecessors, and his interpretation is such that the spirit world responds to it. I think those two things together.
I like that.
Now, this bit about the kind of dig at the legal experts, the scribes, that kind of thing is going to keep showing up over and over again in the Gospel of Mark. There's a conflict that develops, and it's starting right here, although it's real subtle. But by the beginning of chapter 3, it's kind of full blown, where Jesus and the religious authorities of his day are kind of in a conflict. And so we're going to need to pay attention to that kind of as we go. But at this moment, the contrast is Jesus teaches with authority, the legal experts don't.
You know, you can be very familiar with a set of teachings and be able to recite them and sort of follow prescribed paths without really wrestling with them, or without sort of struggling with them, and without adding your own creative energy to them. I mean, we all do this in all sorts of areas of our lives, right? I mean, and I guess that's how I read this, is just sort of they're reciting the teachings that they know, and maybe get into potentially like pedantic arguments about the details of such and such tradition that's been inherited. That's what I imagine that Mark is describing.
I think that's right. I like that a lot. And so to me, when Christians, but especially Christian pastors like myself, read legal experts and scribes or Pharisees, we ought to think about that as referring to ourselves. Right, the dangers of being a religious functionary for whom the kind of doing of the task has replaced the like authority of the spirit. The gospel rightly proclaimed ought to make the spirit world tremble, is what this text is saying. And you know, that's not what happens when you just argue fine points of theological minutia.
But I love theological minutia.
I do too.
Can we do theological minutia?
Yeah, I mean, Jesus loved theological minutia too. Not as much in Mark as in some other places, but so you can have the minutia. You just got to also make
have the wow factor, right? Like, you should be amazed. You should stand in abiding astonishment, as Fackenheim would say, at, you know, the miracle of our religious lives. Can we talk about the exorcism?
Yeah, so the unclean spirit cries out, what do you have to do with us? Jesus tells them to be quiet and calls them out of the man. So what do you see in there that you want to talk about?
I mean, again, this is not an area that I know a ton about, but it seems surprising to me that there's no ritual involved. There's no sort of recitation of any kind of protective psalms. Jesus knows immediately that it's like some guy who says, like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And he knows that this is an unclean spirit. And all he has to do is tell the spirit to get out.
Yeah.
And it does.
This, what have you to do with us, is like, it's a little bit, you know, the way that I read that is like, whose place is this, right? Like, why, what are you doing here? Like, this is our place. And there's a sense in which, and this is true, as you were talking about, in Judaism, sort of post-Hebrew Bible, in Enoch and the Dead Sea Scrolls and other places, that the world is kind of under the sway of evil angelic forces.
Yeah.
And the world has become kind of a place where the evil, unclean spirits are dominant. And this is like the Holy Spirit, the Jesus Spirit, the God Spirit, is now re-entering to reclaim the space. This is the opening salvo of the battle to retake the world for the Holy Spirit, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's not even a contest, right? They're just like, oh no! And then,
right.
You know, they just lose. When the unclean spirit says, "We know you are the Holy One," Jesus silences the unclean spirit. Mm-hmm. So the unclean spirit can't make an announcement to the people about who Jesus is. We're going to see this more and more in the Gospel of Mark, so I just want to flag it right here. But there is a phenomenon in the Gospel of Mark that's sometimes called the messianic secret.
That is so interesting. I did not see those things as fitting together, but yes, that totally makes sense.
So a little later on in this story, when Jesus heals the man with leprosy, he's going to tell him also, don't tell anyone.
Don't tell.
And so there's this interesting pattern in Mark's Gospel where Jesus doesn't want anyone to know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I know who Jesus is because we're reading the text, and the text has told us now mm-hmm. a couple of times, and the demons know who Jesus is, but at this point in the text, nobody else understands. And Jesus is making sure that the spirits don't give away the game and let people know who he is. So then in verse 29, after leaving the synagogue, so this would seem to be on the same day, so we're still on the Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
Because in verse 32 we get that evening, and so that notice would be the end of the day that we've been on, or the beginning of the next day. So Jesus, James, and John went home with Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed, sick with a fever, and they told Jesus about her at once. He went to her, took her by the hand, and raised her up. The fever left her, and she served them. When you read that, what are the first things that sort of stick out to you?
So at the end, it says then, in my translation, then the fever left her and she began to serve them. And I just had this picture of like this group of men coming over and this like older woman who was just sick and now she's like bringing them tea.
Yeah.
But I was relieved to see that the Greek verb that's used is sort of related to like the word deacon.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To be a deacon. And that helped me see service less in a sort of power structure kind of authority way and
yeah.
more sort of like an inspired service, right? Like the kind of service that you are moved to want to serve for a cause, not that women serve men or that people serve religious authority. So that was honestly my first reaction to that whole little...
No, I think that's a great reaction. I mean, I think that's a lot of people's first reaction. And I mean, one thing that's worth noting is that verb only gets used a couple other times in Mark. One of them is in Mark 10:45, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of serving is the kind of thing that Jesus himself does. And in some ways, this Peter's mother-in-law becomes, or Simon's mother-in-law becomes like a little bit of a model of what Christians are supposed to be, and even a little bit of a presaging of what Jesus himself does.
Do you think, and the text doesn't really say either way, but I'm assuming they didn't go to Simon's mother-in-law's house in order to heal her. They just went to her house and then remembered that she was sick, so they told Jesus about that?
So Jesus, with Simon's mother-in-law, seems to initiate the interaction. He just sees that she's sick. No one asks him to heal her. She doesn't ask mm-hmm. him to heal her. Jesus just goes and does it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the person with the spirit never asked to be healed of the spirit, the unclean spirit either. Jesus
certainly
just,
not.
Yeah.
No. We never even really hear the voice of that person. We
That's
only
right.
hear the voice of the spirit.
That's right. So there's something here about Jesus of his own authority, of his own volition, is just bringing healing and restoration to people wherever he goes. Like, that's just kind of what he does. There's nothing being said here about her faith or her, you know, her humility. Mm-hmm. She doesn't call
her
him
merit,
Lord.
Nothing.
Yeah,
right.
Nothing.
She's just a woman with a fever. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's right. Okay. So at the end of that story, so this is still one day.
Mm-hmm.
That evening at sunset, people brought to Jesus those who were sick or demon-possessed. The whole town gathered near the door. He healed many who were sick with all kinds of diseases, and he threw out many demons, but he didn't let the demons speak because they recognized him. Any thoughts about that little notice there?
I mean, to me, I think it just sort of goes to what you were saying, that while there is sort of this secret about, or like, there's a desire for this to be held as a secret, it seems like an unreasonable expectation.
Yeah.
That people wouldn't go and talk about this
Yeah. So early in the morning, well before sunrise, Jesus rose and went to a deserted place where he could be alone in prayer. Simon and those with him tracked him down. When they found him, they told him, "Everyone's looking for you." He replied, I love Jesus. "Let's head in the other direction, to the nearby villages, so that I can preach there too. That's why I've come." He traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and throwing out demons.
It's like the paparazzi.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, if the paparazzi were like sick and demon-possessed.
Well, I know, but... Well, your translation is a little different from mine. So in mine, Jesus answers them, "Let us go on to the neighboring towns so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do."
Yeah.
So like the main thing that Jesus has come to do is proclaim the message.
Yeah.
Not cast out demons and
yeah.
heal people.
Yeah.
But when people present themselves to him immediately in need of that, he has the capacity to do it. And so he does it. But he's, like, careful not to let that become what he does. Like, he's careful not to let that overshadow what he's here to do.
Yeah.
Which is proclaim the message that I wish they would expound more upon. But Mark's not going to do that.
That's really interesting because, you know, a lot of times people talk about, you know, put your money where your mouth is or whatever. You know, like, you talk a lot, but, like, can you actually do anything? And I mean, Jesus can both talk and do stuff in this text, but what he says matters is the preaching, not the healing. We saw in the first bit of this text that, you know, the preaching, so we got those two preaching stories with an exorcism sandwich in the middle, and so the preaching and the healing are not actually separable. They're part of the same. But there is a sense in which once Jesus has healed people in one place and the good news of the arrival of the kingdom has come, he doesn't need to go back there. Like, they already got it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go somewhere else where they don't have it yet.
Yeah. No, I mean, it makes me think about, you know, that it's probably like a meme somewhere, but sort of the categorizing thing. Like, there are some things that are very urgent and there are some things that are very important. And then there are things that are, you know, both urgent and important or neither. But it's very easy to pay attention to the urgent things all the time, right? That's like the email thing that dings all the time or the baby that's crying or the whatever. And there's nothing wrong with tending to urgent things.
Yeah.
They're urgent. But they can pull you away from what you know in your sort of gut to be important. Like your mission, you know, Jesus's mission here is to proclaim the message. And the urgency of the throngs of people needing things from him will pull him away from what he knows to be important for his time on earth.
I love that.
There's a lot for me to think about in like congregational life with that and sort of how we care for all of the people in our community. And maybe that is the thing that is important, but to at least pause and sit with that question.
Yeah.
Like is care for the members of our community the most important thing? Are there other things that are also important? Because the care will always feel urgent.
Yes.
At least for me.
Yeah, but the teaching with authority, the preaching, the proclamation of the good news, that's the precursor to everything else. Now, I love that Jesus needed to be out on his own, like as an introvert. You know, I love people, but like when people say, "Hey, let's go back to the party," I'm like, let's go the other direction. Like, I can relate to Jesus right here. And so I don't have a lot to say about that, but I just appreciate that Jesus needs to get away from the crowds and like be someplace alone.
Yeah.
Oh, one other thing that's worth saying is I don't know if this matters or not, but James and John, Peter and Andrew are from Capernaum. And so what they want to do is go back to their hometown and say, "Let's just keep on preaching and healing here in our hometown." And Jesus has called them away from their boats, like we talked about last time, away from their families to go out into the world and do this ministry. And so in some sense, Jesus saying, "Nope, we're not going back to Capernaum, we're moving on," feels to me like a step in this kind of disciple journey of we're now moving away from your familiar territory, from your familiar people. You might want to go back to the place that's comfortable to you, but that's not where we're headed. We're headed someplace else.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. I think holding that together with the idea that even though there are so many more people who might need healing within that town, it's time to go.
Yeah.
Like, no, the work is not finished, but doing that work is a little bit tangential to the mission or, you know, supplemental to the mission or something. It creates a lot of tension and drama, and it makes me appreciate how hard this mission was that Jesus had. That's hard.
And the disciples following him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're somewhere now in Galilee and preaching in the synagogues and throwing out demons. And then we get this last story for today. A man with a skin disease, sometimes that's translated as leprosy.
Yeah, in our NRSV it says a leper.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about it, do you want to say anything about when you hear with your Hebrew Bible ears that someone has skin disease or someone has leprosy, where do you go in terms of your Hebrew Bible knowledge about this person?
The Hebrew Bible has the book of Leviticus, surprisingly, I know you would guess it would be in Genesis. No, Leviticus has a lot to say about tzara'at, this skin ailment, but it is not only skins that can be affected. It is also houses and cloth and like wool. So when you're trying to picture like what this is, it's some kind of fungus-y, scaly situation. Like it is not Hansen's disease. It is not what we would call leprosy now. And for whatever reason, in Leviticus 13 and 14, it is dealt with as something that puts you into a state of being ritually unclean.
Yeah.
In those stories in Leviticus, it doesn't say anything about like you've done anything wrong to become ritually unclean.
Right.
You just are.
Right.
And so there is, you know, you sort of like, you kind of wait and watch until it seems to have mostly resolved itself and then offer some bizarre, there are strange rituals that are done to sort of wrap up the whole process and sort of mark that transition back from unclean to clean so you can come back into the community. But people who were, who had this ailment were kept away from the ritual life of the community. They were really sort of pushed to the outskirts of the community or put in isolation.
In Leviticus 13:45 and 46, anyone with an infection of skin disease must wear torn clothes, dishevel their hair, cover their upper lip, and shout, "Unclean, unclean." They will be unclean as long as they are infected. They are unclean. They must live alone outside the camp.
Mm-hmm.
So this really is something that created, like, it broke community for those people.
Yeah, it has big social ramifications, yeah.
So we ought to have that in mind as we read this story about Jesus encountering this fellow. So, a man with a skin disease approached Jesus, fell to his knees, and begged, "If you want, you can make me clean." Now, verse 41 has a translational issue. What is Jesus' attitude in the NRSV in verse 41?
Jesus is moved with pity.
Yeah. In the Common English Bible, Jesus is incensed.
Oh, those are very different.
Very different.
Oh, goodness.
So, there's a variant manuscript tradition between incensed or became angry and became filled with compassion. And in fact, the dominant manuscript tradition reads the way the NRSV does, which is he became filled with compassion. But a lot of scholars think that he became angry or he became incensed is probably the original reading there. And the reason is, as a text critical scholar, this idea of the more difficult text is often original.
Yeah.
That is, you can imagine why someone would pick up a text that read, "He became angry," and change it to, "He became compassionate."
Yeah.
But it's hard to imagine why someone would pick up a text that said, "He became compassionate," and change it to, "He became angry." So a lot of scholars will argue there that one ought to read Jesus as angry or incensed in verse 41 instead of compassionate. So for now, I'll just note that, and then maybe we can come back and talk.
Yeah.
In the CEB, incensed, Jesus reached out his hand, touched him, and said, "I do want to be clean." Instantly, the skin disease left him, and he was clean. Sternly, Jesus sent him away, saying, "Don't say anything to anyone. Instead, go and show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifice for your cleansing that Moses commanded. This will be a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and started talking freely and spreading the news so that Jesus wasn't able to enter a town openly. He remained outside in deserted places, but people came to him from everywhere.
I have so much more empathy for Jesus reading this now than I think I read this gospel maybe 20 years ago. Yeah, I just have so much more empathy for Jesus now. Jesus is trying to do something. Like, Jesus has this mission, and these people it's the urgency versus importance. issue. Okay, yeah. I'll stop. I'm not leading you into the text.
No, but that's a really important observation, and it keeps showing up over and over again in this gospel. You'll see as we go.
Yeah.
And in some ways, Jesus, yeah, he's trying to do this thing, and needy people keep showing up, and his reputation keeps spreading, and it makes him harder to do.
It makes it harder and harder for him to do what he understands to be his actual job.
Right.
You know? And when I read this 20 years ago, I think I just wasn't, I mean, I guess I hadn't really lived into adulthood where that's just so often the case, where you have something you're trying to do, and then lo and behold, you know, there are 8,000 other things
right.
that seem also to be important that you feel like you need to attend to, but you're aware that they're pulling you away from whatever you believe is what you need to do. That's what I see here, and I totally see how when this person got down on his knees and begged Jesus, you know, saying, if you choose, you can make me clean, that Jesus would have felt anger before pity.
Yeah.
Because you would feel like you have no choice. Like, what am I going to say? No?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't choose. Too bad for you. But there's someone like physically blocking your path, like blocking the work that you believe is what you've been sent here to do.
Honestly, I like that reading a lot because, like, that happens to me where I get frustrated with people whose concerns are entirely legitimate. You know, I work with a homeless community,
mm-hmm.
and people are perpetually needing things from me, which is not the thing that I was wanting to do next.
That you're intending to offer, yeah.
And I get frustrated. And the thing that I like about this is Jesus gets angry and he does the thing anyway,
yeah.
and the man is healed.
Yep.
So both of those things can be true at the same time. Jesus can be
that's,
like, oh my
yeah,
gosh.
That's really beautiful.
And mm-hmm. also, he ends up acting compassionately, even if his first response was not compassionate. So the last thing that I want to ask, I think, about this text is, this time Jesus says, don't tell anyone, so that we've heard that before. But,
yeah.
But then he says, instead, go show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifice for your cleansing as that Moses commanded. So that's in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
This will be a testimony to them. And so I'm just curious what you do with that little bit of that text.
That is a really good question. And I don't know what to do with this text. The testimony to what?
Yeah. So the first part, go do the things that you're supposed to do.
Sure.
To me, that sounds like Jesus is saying, even though you were healed in this miraculous way, the commandments of the Torah are still the commandments of the Torah, and you ought to observe them. And so
mm-hmm.
go to the priest, do the things that you're supposed to do, get restored to the community the way you're supposed to get restored to the community. That, to me, all of that just reads like Jesus is saying, yeah, keep the Torah. But then that last line, this will be a testimony to them, throws a different kind of a spin on that.
Mm-hmm.
I can read this in two completely opposite ways. One of them, which I like better, is to say, this is Jesus saying to the religious authorities that he respects the religious authorities and that the things he's doing are in no way contradictory to the way that things are done. He's like, he's saying, this ministry that I have fits in with this ministry at the temple, and so we need to make that connection. And
mm-hmm.
so this will be testimony to the people who are at the temple that we value the temple.
Mm-hmm.
The other way to read it is exactly the opposite of that,
right?
Which is
right.
Jesus saying, like, go show them that I can do this thing, and we didn't actually need them. And so all of these rules that they have about restoring people to community, like, show them that those are not really necessary. So one question is, like, what does Mark mean here? And the other question is, how ought we to read it? And I don't know if I have a good answer to either one of those questions.
Maybe both of your readings are a little bit in there. Like, Jesus is not trying to go totally rogue. Like, this is the system that's in operation, but also is wanting them to have some testimony that, first of all, this cleansing happened outside the context of the priesthood, and that Jesus had the sort of spiritual authority to do it, sort of to show them that, like, we'll continue with your system because your system is in play right now, but
yeah.
you should be aware that the words that came to my head were, it's a sham. That's probably a little strong, but that either there are other forces as powerful as you or more powerful than you, or the things you thought were true about the way all this works are not actually true.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's clearly developing in Mark, and it'll get stronger very much so as we go, is a conflict about proper religious function.
Yeah.
And so this is very the very beginning of that. I think fairly clearly Jesus is saying, like, there are lots of ways of being religious, and this is true in ancient Judaism, this is true in modern Judaism, this is true in modern Christianity. There are ways of being religious that, like, get to the core of the thing that the religion is about, and there are ways mm-hmm. of being religious that are kind of focused on the tangential things.
Right, get a little distracted.
Mm-hmm. And so Jesus, part of this thing about Jesus has authority is he's focused on the right parts of the thing. And so he's correcting his tradition, I think. And mm-hmm. in some way, this is related to that. Okay, Amy, so there's a lot that, I mean, we've got several related stories, but there's just a lot of things that are happening in this text. If you were going to pick out one or two that's having particular interest for you or particular relevance to contemporary community, where would you go?
I am really attached to that sort of message of, like, keep your eye on the prize, mm-hmm. like, figure out what it is you feel that you're here to do, mm-hmm. but not necessarily in a way that is single-minded. You know, Jesus doesn't refuse to do any of this healing, but I think it would be a very different story if Jesus then just stayed in Capernaum and healed everybody forever.
Yeah.
Right? Then, I don't know, that sort of the question of what is important and what is urgent and how do we care for our very human embodied needs of our community members and also think mm-hmm. about what is the world we're trying to create and mm-hmm. that moves beyond the people in our community mm-hmm. to live with that tension is that's the work, right? That's the work we have to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that I'm going somewhere very similar. To me, one of the things that's been standing out to me in this reading of this passage, which I'm not sure has been what stood out to me previously, but is that for Jesus, the thing that is the most important is the proclamation mm-hmm. of which the healing is a demonstration or it's the confirmation, but it's not the thing. Mm-hmm. And so the proclamation of the coming of the kingdom, right? And, you know, not here, but in Luke's gospel, for instance, that's the messianic age that's indicated by the liberating of the captives and the healing of the sick and so on. Those who have been suffering in this world will be lifted up. And in my kind of mainline Protestant tradition, we have historically been very good at, like, actually kind of helping those things happen, right? Like using our resources to take care of people and, like, mm-hmm. doing a lot of social good in the world. We're pretty good at that part, but we have often been less good at the teaching and preaching with authority and just kind of, like, invoking the name of Jesus and saying this is what the gospel is about and shaping people's hearts and minds toward this idea that the world could be different than it is because God is bringing something new to us. Mm-hmm. When truth needs to be contested, and I think in our time, truth is very much contested. Mm-hmm. And there's two parts to that. One is silencing those who speak falsehoods, but the other is speaking a truth that cuts through all the crap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, a lot of my kind of folk are nervous about the speaking truth too forcefully.
Right. In some ways, it's more comfortable to serve the people immediately in front of you, right? To sort of live your faith that way is more...
That's exactly it.
Comfortable. That was a great conversation. I really ended somewhere different than where I started, and I appreciate that. That's what I most appreciate about our conversations.
I did too, and likewise.
It's great talking with you.
It's good to talk with you too, Amy. I will see you next time.
Talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye everybody.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of NLDR, the Narrative Lectionary Podcast for People on the Go. We'll be back next week to discuss Mark 2:1-22, in which Jesus heals a paralytic, eats with tax collectors, and gets himself in trouble with the religious authorities. We'll see you then.